3 weeks ago today, I was reading in a devotional book that I read every day called Grace Notes. Philip Yancey put it together. I was reading in there, and what it said that day got my attention. And Jody and Nathan and I were getting together to kind of plan what we're going to do at the leadership retreat. So I shared that thought, and that it evolved into what I shared there and what I'm going to share with you today. We're going to call it Rediscovering Grace. Well, that's what Nathan put on it for a title, so that's what we're going to call it, Rediscovering Grace. I want to share that article with you, that devotional with you, to get us started. And then we're going to, well, you'll see where we'll go from there. He says this, a pamphlet I read on Mormonism was praised certain characteristics, industriousness, self-reliance, resistance to government interference. Mormons point to upright living, high achievement, and sterling citizenship as primary proofs of their faith. Despite the obvious appeal of all these qualities, something nagged at me as I read the pamphlet. The virtues it extolled brought to mind not Mormons, but evangelicals. Virtually every word could have been written in a brochure promoting evangelicals. Do we not want to be known for good citizenship, industriousness, righteousness, and temperance? One of Walker Percy's characters in his book, The Second Coming, comments, I am surrounded by Christians. They are generally speaking a pleasant and agreeable lot, but noticeably different from other people. But if they have the truth, why is it the case that they are repellent precisely to the degree they embrace and advertise the truth? A mystery. If the good news is true, why is not one pleased to hear it? And that's what jumped out at me. I'll share the rest of this article too. If the good news is true, why is not one pleased to hear it? His last question rings loud. Could it be that Christians, eager to point out how good they are, neglect one basic fact, that the gospel comes as a eucatastrophe? How many know what a eucatastrophe is?
We got one guy that knows what a eucatastrophe is. We got one guy that's got it written down, so that's two of us. That's got the word catastrophe in it, and that sounds bad to me. Now, a eucatastrophe, you don't know what it is?
A eucatastrophe is a sudden and favorable resolution of events in a story. It's a happy ending. Or as Yancey puts in here, it's a spectacularly good thing happening to spectacularly bad people. A eucatastrophe. The gospel, he says, is a eucatastrophe, a spectacularly good thing happening to spectacularly bad people. Since evangelicals have been busily reading into the congressional record biblical rationales on abortion, the Department of Education, tobacco subsidies, and sundry Supreme Court decisions, I would propose an important and corrective balance. In our churches, why not spend more time discussing the implication of Jesus' parable of the righteous man and the tax collector? That's from Luke chapter 18, and we'll touch on that sometime. One man thanked God for his blessings, that he was not a robber, an evildoer, an adulterer, or a tax collector. He fasted twice a week. He tithed his income. The other had questionable morality, not much in the way of a resume, and thoroughly inadequate theology. One prayed eloquently. The other used seven simple words, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. And yet, which one went home justified? Curiously, the righteous Pharisees had little historical impact save for a brief time in a remote corner of the Roman Empire. But Jesus' disciples, an ornery, undependable, and hopelessly flawed group, became drunk with the power of the gospel that offered free forgiveness to the worst sinners and traitors. And those disciples managed to change the world. But the question that jumped out at me was, if the good news is true, why is not one pleased to hear it? And I believe that the reason is, very simply put, grace, or a lack of it. Because if we go and take a look at what we're going to do today, and we look at what God has done for us, we're going to find out that the reason that it's not good news, or it's not accepted as good news, is because people don't understand it. And so what we've got today, we're going to talk about today, is kind of an evolution of thought for rediscovering grace. Grace is a subject that permeates the Scriptures. It's the very defining element of our new covenant, of the new covenant. During a British conference on comparative religions, experts from around the world debated what, if any, belief was unique to the Christian faith. They began eliminating possibilities. Incarnation, several religions had various forms of God appearing in human forms. Resurrection, several of the religions have accounts of return from death. The debate went on for some time until C.S. Lewis entered the room. He wondered what was all the problem about? And he heard in reply that they were discussing Christianity's unique contribution among world religions. Lewis responded, "Oh, it's easy. It's grace." After some discussion, the conferees had to agree the notion of God's love coming to you and me, us, free of charge, no strings attached, seemed to go against every instinct of humanity. The Buddhists have an eightfold path. The Hindus have karma. The Jewish covenant, just law after law. The Muslim code of law. Each offers a way to earn our approval to God. Only Christianity dares to make God's love unconditional. Rediscovering grace fits into three categories, I believe. One is personal. Number one is you and me. It's us, me, you. It's on our level. Secondly, needed in the church. Grace within the body of ourselves. And then thirdly, extending out to the lost. Let's start on the personal level. The me part. The personal. Grace to me is very precious. Hasn't always been that way, I guess you could say. I grew up in the church. A very legalistic branch. We didn't smoke. We didn't drink. We didn't have TV. We didn't go to movies. We didn't dance. We didn't wear shorts. We didn't play cards. We didn't wear wire-rimmed glasses. We didn't wear makeup and jewelry. We didn't listen to rock music. Some of us didn't even celebrate Christmas or Easter or Halloween. We tithed. We had three services each week, which we didn't miss. We had the Lord's Supper weekly. We believed that nobody that didn't believe our concept of baptism was saved. Our circle was small, and it got smaller. It grew and it shrunk depending on just exactly how you felt about things. Our Christianity was built around the church and around Jesus Christ, sure, but it was also based on works, earning your approval to God. We preached grace, but a very shackled grace. Does it sound familiar? Jesus saved, but we had to work hard to attain it and maintain it. A lot of our people felt burdened, very burdened. Discouraged, saw Christianity as a pain, not a privilege. Many backslid.
We kept people by pressure and coercion, fear and guilt. We kept them in line that way.
What we needed more than anything was understand grace.
We thought we did, but we didn't have it figured out. But we felt pretty good about ourselves. We were good. Look at all the things we weren't doing wrong, in our viewpoint. Look at all the good things we were doing right, in our viewpoint. And Christianity was good news. We believed in forgiveness. We believed in heaven. We longed for heaven. But it really was more based on us than it was based on Jesus Christ. That was, and that maybe sounds familiar to you, that was religion, and that's a lot of what Christianity is, a lot of people. But then I crashed. Had an affair. She became pregnant, and oh my. Have you ever read about David and Bathsheba? You know the desperation that David felt? Do you remember reading about that? I know what that's like. I know desperation. What do you do now? For suddenly I was too bad to be good enough. I always had been, but I didn't recognize it before. Now I was too bad to be good enough. I was caught. And like David, it took a while of sorting. It took a long time to sort things out. And when you're in that situation, you can do one or two things. You can either turn to God or turn from Him. You can run to Him or you can run from Him. I turned to Him. Finally, and for the first time ever, I recognized that there was nothing I could do to make it okay. Nothing. He was my only hope. I needed forgiveness. I needed His mercy, His grace, His love. And He gave it. The toughest thing to understand and to grasp a hold of is He gave it unconditionally. Not a thing that I did except holler for help. I was a messed up sinner, but a forgiven one. And the huge burden was lifted. I discovered grace, or rediscovered grace, however you want to put it. A huge burden was lifted, not only from my sin, but from my mentality. The thought that I had to work it out, the thought that I had to do something to get to heaven, to please God, was gone. And I recognized that all I needed to do was turn to Him, and He took care of it. I let God do it, and He did it. And now I could rest in the glow of His love, His mercy, His grace, and forgiveness. No, He didn't fix all the damage. I still had to deal with a lot of that. I still have to deal with a lot of that. What a relief. And finally, some of the scriptures that I'd known for years, some of the stories and the parables I'd known for years started taking on a new light. I'm going to use the term a true light. They started making sense again. Luke chapter 2 become one of my very, very favorite passages, where the angels come to the shepherds on the hillside. And the angel says to the shepherds in Luke 2:10, "Don't be afraid, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which shall be for all the people. For today in the city of David there has been born for you a Savior, who is Christ the Lord." Good news of great joy. That's my verse now. I never understood that before.
We said it was good news of great joy, but we really didn't understand it. It's good news of great joy. Going back to the question that was asked when if it is good news, then how come people aren't glad to receive it? How come it isn't welcomed as such? Because we don't understand grace. That's why. I didn't. It's good news of great joy because we recognize there's nothing else in the whole wide world we could do. We had to have Him. Luke chapter 7. Last year we heard quite a bit on this one in the Love Lot series. It's a story Jesus told about Jesus going to the house of the Pharisee. Starting verse 36. Now one of the Pharisees was requesting him, Jesus, to dine with him. And Jesus entered the Pharisee's house and he reclined at the table, and there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she learned that Jesus was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster vial of perfume. And standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears and wiping them with her hair of her head, kissing his feet, anointing them with perfume. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, a mistake. You don't say things to yourself with God listening, okay? He can hear you. But he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of a person this woman was who's touching him, that she is a sinner. Jesus said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he replied, say it, teacher. He said, a certain money lender had two debtors, one who owed 500 denarii and another 50. Now, in our terminology, how many of you use denarii every day? Do you use that term every day? So, in other words, we don't know really what that means, does it? Well, what a denarii actually close to in our thought pattern is a day's pay. Now, depending on how much you make, if you're one of those football players, it's way out of line. But if you're the average Joe, you know, it might be, I don't know, let's just for the fun of it say $100 a day, just to make the numbers easy, okay? That makes the one person owe $50,000 and the other $5,000. Two debtors, one owed $50,000, the other $5,000. Verse 42 says this, when they were unable to repay. That's something I didn't recognize for all my life, that I was unable to repay. How about you? One of the things that a lot of us in the churches today, we think we're good enough. I don't do this. I don't do that. I don't do something else. Look at all the good things I do. It says, but when they were unable to repay, he graciously forgave them both. Which of them, therefore, will love him more? Simon said, I suppose the one he forgave more. Listen to this one closely. He said, you have judged correctly. Turning to the woman, that sinner, if only he had known. Do you see this woman? Duh. Just been thinking about. I entered your house and you gave me no water for my feet. She has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but she, since the time she came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. You didn't anoint my head with oil. She anointed my feet with perfume. For this reason I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little, and that's the problem we face. That's why it's not good news. If it's truly good news, why isn't it accepted that as good news? Because we don't understand grace. We don't understand. We don't understand that you're going to hell the way you are, no matter who you are. You need Jesus Christ. And the only way you're going to get there It's because he forgives you of your sins. And if you're only owing him $5,000, you think you can repay that. That's not so much. I can repay that. It's not so bad. I can do it. But only when you get to be the $50,000 or the $500,000 or the million. Only when you get to the point where you realize you can't take care of that sin of yours, that you really love him. Because those that are forgiven little, love little. Chapter 18. We've already touched on this one. Two men went up to the temple to pray, verse 10, chapter 18. One a Pharisee, the other a tax gatherer. And the Pharisee was praying thus to himself, God, I thank thee that I'm not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like the tax gatherer. I can't say that anymore. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all I get. You know, I used to be that type of a person. I used to say, God, I'm thankful I'm not like somebody else. I don't do that anymore. Because I'm the other guy. The one that has to say, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. That's when it becomes good news. Because we finally understand grace. You know the neat thing about grace? The neat thing about grace, you don't have to be a success to get it. In fact, you've got to be a failure. That's who I am. You see, all the awards and rewards are given to people who win. They have the World Series trophy. They have the Super Bowl trophy. Vince somebody from Wisconsin. They have the Lord Stanley something from Canada for hockey, and I don't know, what do they give out for basketball, because I don't give a rip about basketball. Don't matter. But who gets those? It's the winners that get those. They get into the Hall of Fame. Why? That's the superstars. What do they have for the losers? Grace. Back to chapter 15. Prodigal son. Luke 15:11. He said a certain man had two sons. Let me warn you, don't get caught up on the details. We're going for the real message here. The younger of them said, Father, give me the share of the estate that falls to me. And he divided his wealth between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey to a distant country, and he squandered his estate with loose living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine occurred in the country, and he began to be in need. And he went and he attached himself to the citizens of that country and sent them to the fields to feed swine. He was longing to fill his stomach with the pods that the swine were eating, and no one was giving him anything. A Jewish boy feeding pigs. That don't work. That's how desperate he was. But he came to his senses, it says in verse 17, and he said, how many of my father's hired men have more than enough bread to eat, and I'm dying with hunger. But I'll get up, I'll go to my father, I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight, no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired men. Came to his senses. He got up, he came to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him, felt compassion for him, ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said, or at least he started to say, Father, I have sinned against heaven. In your sight, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to the slaves, bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand, sandals on his feet. Bring the fatted calf, kill it, let us eat, be merry, for this son of mine was dead and has come to life, was lost and has been found, and they began to be merry. He didn't deserve it. Neither do I. You know, I spent all my life being the big brother. When the older brother was in the field, when he came approached the house, he heard dancing and music, and he summoned one of the servants and began to inquire of these things, what's going on? And he said, your brother has come, Your father killed the fatted calf because he received him back safe and sound. And he became angry and wasn't willing to go in. His father came out and began entreating him, said, look, he said, many years I've been serving you. I've never neglected a command of yours, and yet you have never given me a kid that I might be merry with my friends. But when this son of yours comes, who has devoured his wealth with the harlots, you killed a fatted calf for him. And his father said, my child, you've always been with me, and all that's mine is yours. But we had to be merry and rejoice, for this brother of yours was dead and has begun to live, was lost, and has been found. I was the older brother forever, looking down on the people that took off and sinned, until one day that was me. Finally recognized that the prodigal son is us. And if we don't see it that way, it'll never be good news and never be welcomed. Because as long as we're the big brother at home, we're going to be the belly-aching, grouching people complaining about the sinners and never get the message of grace. Grace does a bunch of things. One, it frees. Galatians chapter 5, verse 1 says it was for grace, for freedom, that Christ set you free. That's grace. It frees. It frees. Sins are gone. Mine were huge and they're gone. That's the most wonderful feeling in the world. Most wonderful feeling. Grace reveals our total reliance on God. The Old Testament, Isaiah 64:6 says, you've heard it many times. Maybe it hasn't meant a whole lot to you, but it shall today. 64:6, for all of us have become like one who is unclean, and our righteous deeds are like filthy garments. Grace reveals that there is absolutely nothing that you can do by yourself to clean up your life. We realize finally that we can't wash. It's like a filthy rag. Have you ever tried to clean with a filthy rag? It don't work. You get dirtier. That's what your righteousness does. It only makes you dirtier. It doesn't make you cleaner. The only thing that cleans you up is Jesus Christ. The only thing. The song we sing says, I'm forgiven because you were forsaken. I'm accepted. You were condemned. I'm alive and well. Your spirit is within me because you died and rose again. Amazing love. How can it be that you, my King, would die for me? Grace reveals our total reliance on Him. And it transforms. Grace transforms. Only going to use one place, and that's Colossians 3. But it transforms. Colossians 3:12 says, and so to those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved. Hold on. Who's he talking to? The holy and beloved part. How many of here are holy? How many of you are beloved? Isn't that wonderful? Because you aren't. We're sinners. But he says you're holy and beloved. Not because you're any good, but because he made us that way. He says, to you that are holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, patience, bearing with one another, forgiving one another. You see, we realize once we get the idea that he has changed our life and changed us completely, made us pure and holy, when we figure that one out, it'll change us. 100% it'll change us. The preacher doesn't have to get up and beat on you. He doesn't have to talk you into it. He doesn't have to guilt you into it. Jesus' love does all that. And he took it away. Grace, first of all, has to affect me. Has to affect you. We need to rediscover it. But when we have understood it, and we do see it, it makes a change that's fantastic. Our second thought, rediscovering grace, in the church. The church must not be a museum for the saints. We must recognize that it's a hospital for sinners. To admit we are anything other than sinners saved by grace means we haven't figured out grace. Grace humbles. Grace puts us on the same level as everybody else. Story in Luke chapter 18, where you have the Pharisee who's up there saying, God, I'm thankful I'm not like the rest of those people. Suddenly we're right down there on the ground and we're saying, be merciful to me, the sinner. If the church, you and me, can figure that out, we'll never look down on anybody. We're righteous only in His sight, and because of His washing away of our sins, not because we're sinless. We need to take off the masks. Take off the fakery. And thank God for grace. We need to be a church devoted to helping one another to survive and to win. Like Alcoholics Anonymous, like Celebrate Recovery. We've never won the battle. We're just battling. That's all. And we need to help each other do it. If we don't really understand grace, if we're not rediscovering grace personally, we'll never understand others. Remember the word eucatastrophe? That is some incredibly good thing happening to incredibly bad people. That's me first. And then when I recognize it's me first, then I can help everyone else. After trying many faulty cures, the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the co-founders, Bill Wilson, finally understood that irony. He reached the unshakable conviction, now a canon of the 12-step group, that an alcoholic must hit bottom in order to climb up. He wrote, "How privileged we are to understand so well the divine paradox that strength rises from weakness, humiliation goes before resurrection, and pain is not only the price, but the very touchstone of spiritual rebirth." The irony continues throughout recovery. Although an alcoholic may pray desperately for the condition to go away, very few alcoholics and other addicts report sudden miraculous healing, and most battle temptation every day of their lives. They experience grace not as a magic potion, but rather a balm whose strength is activated daily by their conscience dependence on God. When we recognize every day that we're battling the battle, we're struggling in the battle ourselves, then we understand that so is everybody else around us. What's the mission for the church? What's the church here for, if not to redirect stumbling feet toward our Savior? To be as Celebrate Recovery, helping each other with our hurts and our habits and our hang-ups. Our last thought is on rediscovering grace to the lost. Philip Yancey, in his book, The Jesus I Never Knew, told a true story. And here's the story. He said, "I heard it from a friend who works in the down and out in Chicago. A prostitute came to me in wretched straits, homeless, sick, unable to buy food for her 2-year-old daughter. Through sobs and tears, she told me she had been renting out her daughter, 2 years old, to men interested in kinky sex. She made more renting out her daughter for an hour than she could make in a whole night on her own. She had to do it, she said, to support her drug habit. I could hardly bear hearing her sordid story, and for one thing, it made me legally liable. I'm required to report cases of child abuse. I had no idea what to say to this woman. At last, I asked if she'd ever thought of going to church for help. I'll never forget the look of pure, naive shock that crossed her face. Church, she cried. Why would I ever go there? I was all really feeling terrible about myself, and they just make me feel worse. What struck me about my friend's story, he said, is that women, much like this prostitute, fled toward Jesus, not away from Him. The worse a person felt about herself, the more likely she was to see Jesus as a refuge. Has the church lost that gift? He asks. Evidently, the down and out who flocked to Jesus when he lived on earth no longer feel welcome among his followers. What has happened? Takes us back to our original question that we started out with. If the good news is true, why is not one pleased to hear it? Very simply, the answer is because we aren't sharing grace. John Fisher says in his book, What on Earth Are We Doing? Most non-Christians see Christians as a bunch of goody-two-shoes who look down their noses at the rest of the world. Where do you suppose they got that idea? Maybe it was all that spiritual posturing we did for the sake of our testimonies. Well, our testimonies have backfired on us. By convincing the world we were different, we only succeeded in convincing them that they did not want to have anything to do with us. We may have impressed each other, but we didn't impress the world. We said the gospel's for everyone, but we've acted as if it was just for us. We cut ourselves off from that which makes us common with the rest of the world. We've cultivated an image that has nothing to do with sin and thus nothing to do with sinners. We've distanced ourselves from the world and taken on a spiritual pride. It's a sad day for the gospel when it's seen as good news only for good people. For the sake of the gospel, it's time to show the world how very much the same we are. It's time to join Paul on the worst of the sinners list. Paul says in 1 Timothy 1:15, here's a trustworthy statement that deserves full acceptance. Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am the worst. Can't you imagine him at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, getting up and saying, hi guys, I'm Paul, a sinner, the worst. In cultural war of issues, it's easy to forget that the world is made up of men and women for whom Christ died. It was because of their sin and lostness of humanity that Christ came to redeem us, to buy us back with his own blood. He came because God loved his own and didn't want us to die in our trespasses and sins, a death that was nevertheless required by his holiness and justice. And so the death of Christ in our place made a relationship between the Creator and his creation possible. All motivated by love, God's love, his desire to save that which was lost, the central message of the gospel. And if we're concerned about getting the gospel out to the world, we will need to change our attitudes toward the world and see the world not so much as wrong as lost. You see, because when we look at something as being lost, it had a value to us and we cherished it. You go to the 15th chapter of Luke. All three of the stories are about lost things. There's a lost sheep. He leaves his 99 that weren't lost to go find one that is. It was lost. It was valuable. She has 10 coins. She loses one. She's got 9 that are okay that she has, but she goes and finds that one that was lost. It's valuable. The man has 2 sons. One's at home. He's okay. The other one is lost. It's valuable. When you think of someone as lost, you have a different attitude toward them than if they were wrong. You don't try to set them straight. You try to find them. Bring them home safely. Jesus had compassion on the multitudes because they were like a sheep without a shepherd. He didn't put them in religious or political camps. They weren't Romans and zealots and Gentiles and liberals and conservatives. They were lost. His favorite stories were about finding things that were lost. A couple weeks ago in the news, 2 girls, 15 and 17, were charged with bullying and abusing, physically and sexually, a 16-year-old autistic boy. How does that make you feel? There was an apartment explosion in which some people were killed, and they'd been complaining for days about the smell of gas. How does that make you feel? When When we look out at people, when we look out at those that are messing up, how do we feel? How do we deal with those that are different than us? How do you deal with those? When someone is elected to office, president, senator, representative, judge, etc., when they don't do what you want, how do you feel about them? How many of you voted for Obama? Not very many of us, were there? How do you think God feels about the way you treat your president, your senators, your judges? Max Lucado said, told this story. Some years ago, he said a Rottweiler attacked our golden retriever puppy at a kennel. That worthless animal climbed out of its run and into Molly's and nearly killed her. He left her with dozens of gashes and a dangling ear. My feelings toward the mutt were less than... they weren't good at all. Leave the two of us in an area and only one would have come out. I wrote a letter to the dog's owner urging him to put the dog to sleep. When I showed the letter to the kennel owner, she begged me to reconsider. What that dog did was horrible, she said, but I'm still training him. I'm not finished with him yet. God would say the same thing about the Rottweilers that attack you in your world. I'm not finished with them yet. Your enemies still figure into God's plan. Why do I know that? Because they're still alive. God hasn't given up on them. They may be out of God's will, but they're not out of his reach. And you honor God when you see them not as his failures, but as his projects. Matthew chapter 5, verses 14 through 16 say this. You are the light. Jesus saying this. This is Jesus, not me. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do men light a lamp and put it under a peck measure, but on a lampstand to give light to all that are in the house. Let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. We are the light for the world. And that light is grace. Titus chapter 2 says, when the grace of God had appeared, this and this and that will happen. Jesus is the grace. Are we letting grace shine? Jesus looked out on the multitudes one day, it says in Matthew 9, and he saw them as sheep without a shepherd, and he had compassion on them. How do we feel about people out in the world? On the verse after John 3:16, it says this. For God didn't send his Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world should be saved through him. That's our mission. We're Jesus here on this earth. Some people think their job is to judge. Oh, that's easy to do. I've spent most of my 60 years doing it. But that's not what we're here for. Jesus said when the Spirit comes, he will convict the world concerning sin, righteousness, and judgment. Our job is to be the light, to share grace. You know, there's a real hot topic out there in this world today. It's debated by so many. It's called conceal and carry. It's finally coming to Illinois. Or it's finally come. Just for the record, it's a very bad idea. But we want to, for our illustration today, we want to change that a tad bit. Not to conceal and carry. You know where I'm going with that, don't you? We're talking about grace. Let's change it to reveal and share it, not conceal and carry. As Christians who have experienced the grace of God in our lives, as a church that knows what grace is, let's reveal it and share it to the world. so that they can understand what grace is. Rediscovering grace, so needed today in our world and among our people, so needed among us as individuals. I hope you don't have to hit the bottom before you figure out what grace is. But if you do, I hope it happens, because you need to know what grace is. It needs to be a personal thing to you. And when it's a personal thing to you, then it becomes a personal thing in the church. When it becomes a personal thing in the church, we can reach out to the world and share the grace of Jesus Christ, because that's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. They're going to sing a song here in a few minutes. I was looking ahead. Part of that says, because you gave your life, you lived, you died for me, you paid the price, you sacrificed for me. That's grace. Most wonderful thing in the whole wide world. And if you need it today, that's what it's all about. They're going to come up here and they're going to sing. They're going to give you an opportunity to respond to this. If you haven't experienced grace, if you've never grabbed any of it to begin with, we'll use Eldon's philosophy here. This is the area for you to come to today. Come and get grace. If you need to just deal with it personally with God, over there. If you need somebody's help, here in the middle. But we need grace more than anything else in the whole wide world. We need to rediscover it. The church needs to be known for its grace and its mercy and its love and its forgiveness. We need to share it.